All right, we are ready. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navadhitamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti, 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 Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam, Sarvabhuta Guhashayam, Yat Sarva Vishayatitam, Asmai Sarva Vyade Namaha. Om. Good. Nice to see you all today. Welcome also to the many students attending these classes regularly online. We continue, and I mentioned in a prior class that I thought I would be cherry-picking these verses more than I am, and so far I've removed very few of the cherries, so to speak. This chapter is really quite compelling. A little long, but it's quite important, so we will continue to make our way through the chapter. Just check this. Everything looks okay. So, at the end of our prior class, we had one of the very important discussions we have in Advaita Vedanta, a discussion we've had before, about the fact that all of our efforts to gain peace and contentment are limited, finite. Anything we do in the world is limited, finite. And the irony, of course, is what we seek in life is perfect contentment. Reflect on that just for a moment. Perfect contentment. We seek a state of perfection, nothing less. Would you be okay? I gave this example long ago. If I could give you a pill that would make you happy and content 99% of the time, pretty good, right? Imagine if you could be happy and content 99% of the time. But if today were the 1% that you felt absolutely miserable, you would complain to me, Swamiji, what's wrong with your pill? I feel terrible today. So the point of that silly story is to illustrate the fact that what we truly seek is a state of perfection. And there's actually an analysis that goes, I hadn't planned to do this introduction, but it seems important and certainly relevant. An analysis that's given elsewhere, not by Shankara, but elsewhere in the teachings of Advaita is this. The fact that we seek a state of perfection suggests that there's a state of perfection to be gained. This is a little bit of logic. There is an intuitive sense we all have, according to this analysis, that our true natures are indeed perfect, but there's some impediment that's a little abstract. So a metaphor that really drives it home is, if you have a speck of dust in your eye, it's really uncomfortable. It's interesting that it's just this tiny little speck, but that's all it takes to be make you uncomfortable. Well, that the moments when we're not content and peaceful in life are like that speck of dust. The dust feels like something that shouldn't be there. In the same way, sadness feels like something that shouldn't be there, frustration, anger, whatever it is that makes us suffering in general, physical suffering, mental suffering, all of that feels like it shouldn't be there. We want to get rid of it, just like we want to get rid of the speck of dust in our eyes. Anyway, the introduction to this next couple of verses is the fact that what we seek in life is a state of perfection. And we've been through the analysis before, that no amount of human effort can ever lead you to a state of perfection. So we're stuck. Of course, we're stuck if it's only human effort, and that's what Shankara is going to explain here today. So we'll pick up the thread with verse 50. Tapam tattvara nityatvad, tapam tattvara nityatvad, atmar tattvad chayabahihi, atmar tattvad chayabahihi, samhrityatmanitam pritam, satyatmanitam pritam, satyati gurumashrayet, satyati gurumashrayet. So Shankara here summarizes all the limitations of worldly effort in three ways. He says, take the second word first. He says, anityatvat, because all of your efforts culminate in a result which is anitya, temporary, ephemeral. Whatever you get goes away. Right? Whatever comes up goes down. Whatever you get is temporary, is limited, as we just discussed. Now, two more reasons, he says. Tapantatvat. Everything you do, tapa here refers to not tapas, but effort. Everything you do requires effort, lots of effort. When you spend money, it would be interesting to convert the amount of money you spend into how many hours you had to work for that money. By the way, you should include not only how many hours you spent at your job, but how many hours you spent gaining the professional training or whatever it is, how many hours you spent in school, how many hours you spent in some kind of internship. When you analyze things, buying that $100 gadget actually requires a significant amount of effort. There's an expenditure on your part and an expenditure of effort. Of course, what we really want is contentment. Does contentment require effort? In fact, it's kind of opposite, right? So as long as we are striving, we are not content. And that's the second point here. The third one, atmartatvat. Whatever we pursue in life is atma-artha, for one's own sake. And what that means, we've had this discussion several times, and that is the true source of contentment, peace, happiness, joy lies within us. You've heard that many times. You also know it very clearly. You know, the example you've heard me give before is when you eat ice cream and enjoy it, is the enjoyment coming from the ice cream? Is it one of the ingredients? So therefore, where does the enjoyment come from? Very, very obvious, and you all know that so clearly. Any intelligent person knows that. So then why isn't that reflected in our day-to-day behavior? Why do we continue to be so focused on external sources of contentment when we claim to know that the true source of peace and contentment is within? There's some confusion here, which is why Shankara writes so many verses and why we have so many classes. So this is his observation, and so now he says in the end of the second line, ya bahihi, connected to the next line down, pritim. Those external, ya bahihi, those external pritim, tam pritim, those external sources of contentment, should we call them apparent sources of contentment? Would that be more accurate? Is ice cream a source of contentment? Certainly not. So let's be specific. All of those apparent sources of contentment outside, what about them? Sri Shankara says, samhrit. Pratitya. You should withdraw, Atmani, you should withdraw yourself from all those external sources of contentment. When you finally figure it out, well, you've already figured it out. When there is a shift of perspective in your mind and heart about what is truly valuable in life. For most people, what is truly valuable in life is out there, you know, through whatever are their chosen forms of entertainment, etc. But I think for all of us here, there's been a transformation of thinking in which we realize that even though all those things out there are fun, none of them is a source of perfect peace and contentment. And therefore, we shift our perspective in a way that we're no longer so fixated on chasing after the latest cool gadget out there, and our attention is turned around 180 degrees, so to speak, and focused within. That's what Sri Shankara says. Atmani samkritya. You withdraw your attention and turn it within, seeking the true source of contentment and peace. Now we have a little problem, though. So if you are intellectually convinced that the true source of contentment and peace is not out there, so you close your eyes and say, okay, it must be inside. You close your eyes and look. So where is it? There's another layer to the problem here. And that layer refers to the fact that we're going to need some help in finding that true source of contentment within. Not surprisingly, that source of content, that guidance comes from Guru, which is what Shankara concludes this verse with. He says, Satyarthi, the one who is, the arti means seeker, the seeker of satya, truth, here, the true source of contentment and peace within, that satyarthi, that seeker of the truth of one's true nature, what should that person do? Obviously, gurum ashrayet, that person should seek a guru. What kind of guru? Oh, because I publish a lot of videos on YouTube, I watch a lot of videos on YouTube. Videos of other gurus. And what do they say? Buyer beware. So there is some legitimate stuff out there, but there's lots of kooky people. The unique characteristic of YouTube is you just declare yourself, here I am. Yeah, the other day I found there was one. This was actually a disciple of Osho, who. The title of his, every channel has a name. So the name of his channel, I forget the exact wording, but something about enlightened guru. So he self-declaims, declares that he is an enlightened guru, and that becomes the title of his channel. Well, take a look at it and you let me know what you think. All right. So who is that enlightened guru? What kind of guru should you seek? Shantam pragyam tata muktam. Shantam pragyam tata muktam. Nishkriyam brahmane nisthitam. Nishkriyam brahmane nisthitam. Shuteracharyavan Veda, tad viddhiti smritestata. Before we see Shankara's explanation here, in I think it's Mundaka Upanishad, the simple and most direct definition of what makes a person qualified to be a guru? There are two terms given, and that is Shrotriyam and Brahmanishtam. Tam guru meva, abhigachet. Brahmanabhihi Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. I think I made one mistake in that word, Brahmanabhihi. Something is there. Anyway, the two qualifications, Shrotriyam, skilled in the scriptural traditions. A nice metaphor that's helpful to understand these two terms is if you are in India and you want to go up to one of the four dhams, the four pilgrimage places up in the Himalayas, and you want to get a guide, do you want a guide who has a map or is clueless about how to navigate all the roads up there? So definitely the guru may not have a physical map. The tour guide may not have a physical map. It may be in the brain, it may be on their GPS device, but there's a map involved. If the tour guide doesn't know the network of roads, that's not the right tour guide for you. So first thing is the map. Scriptures are well compared to a map. This is not our topic right now. I won't go further on it. But think of scriptures as a map that guides you to a destination, except in this case the destination isn't up in the Himalayas. The destination is within yourself. So that's the first of these two requirements. The term used in the Upanishad is Shrotriyam, one who is skilled in the scriptural tradition. And the second term that's used is Brahmanishtam, one who is established in Brahman. And to apply it to the metaphor, do you want a tour guide who has never been to the place you want to go? No, you want a tour guide who's actually not just has the map or knows the way, but a tour guide who's been there. So this would refer to the two basic qualifications for a guru. I find this very simple and direct. The guru should be skilled in the scriptural tradition, which contains the crucial guidance, the methodology that we use. And then secondly, the guru should have discovered what you want to discover in simple languages. That part is simple. Knowing whether or not your guru actually has those requirements is a little bit more complicated. We'll see that in a moment. Let's just see how Shankara describes everything. And everything taught by Shankara and about guru ends up being pinned on those two terms I just mentioned. So the guru you should seek is one who is shantam, peaceful. That's kind of a no-brainer, as we would say in American English. But here, prajñam, wise, and that term definitely refers to this being trained in a scriptural tradition. So Shankara uses that term, prajñam, wise, not wise in a general sense, but wise specifically, well-trained in the scriptural tradition. And that's actually fairly easy to determine if you are evaluating someone's value as a potential guru. And you find out, you know, who is their guru? And the guru's guru, and the guru's, and similarly, you find out what is a guru's tradition. Some of those YouTube gurus have no tradition, and they basically make it all up themselves. Well, you take your chances with that. You know, are they making up things which are really helpful? Or are they making up things which just sound really compelling, which is often the case? The other factor, I've mentioned this several times, and I think it's significant, and that is the roadmap happens to be in Sanskrit. That's just a fact. And it's also a fact that even the best translations are problematic. And I'm kind of saying this with some weight because I am personally shocked by how many modern gurus can't read the roadmap. And to me, that seems like a huge shortcoming. And it's not like it's so difficult to learn Sanskrit. The difficulty of learning Sanskrit, the grammar is a little bit complicated, but in fact, the structure of Sanskrit grammar is often compared to of the Germanic languages, German. Because German has some complicated grammar, also has great use of compound words. So, is it impossible to learn how to speak German? Not easy, but certainly not impossible. So if you can learn to speak German, then why not learn? Anyway, you get my point. Okay, so the roadmap happens to be in Sanskrit. So your guru should be prajñam, trained in the scriptural tradition. Also, muktam, liberated, free. The guru should have discovered what you want to discover, realized what you want to realize. Some other words he adds here is nishkriyam, literally actionless. We might paraphrase it as agendaless. Sorry to point this out, but a lot of those YouTube gurus have an agenda. For example, they earn money from their YouTube channels. So the more people who watch their YouTube channels, the more money they make. You may notice that our YouTube channel is not monetized. We don't make any money. In fact, we spend money on it. We don't make any money on it. So what is, if a guru has an agenda, maybe you should think about what is the guru's agenda? What are they after? Actually, one of our satsang questions we'll see later today is, what about gurus who have an agenda to proselytize? I've discovered the greatest thing, and you should discover it too. Listen. To me, that's a red flag. Any need? If you think about proselytization in other religious traditions, actually, let me not get off on I get off on these long detours. This is a good place to edit myself. We won't go off on this detour anyway. In my opinion, I think if a guru is really focused on gaining students, gaining disciples, pushing their message, to me that's very much a red flag. And the final description Shankara gives here, brahmani stitam. In fact, that means exactly the same as brahmanishtam. Nishta being established, brahmani in Brahman, as we've already discussed. And nishkriyam, I think there's a typo in the Sanskrit word. So, having explained these qualities of an adequate guru, a proper guru, Shankara now refers to the scriptural basis for these requirements. He says, "Shrutehi," in the third line, according to the scriptures, and he gives two examples. According to the Upanishad, that says, "Acharyavan Veda." This is a quotation from the Chandogya Upanishad. Very good example. It's a famous story about somebody walking down the road who is kidnapped by thieves, and the thieves rob him of all of his money and then tie a blindfold around his eyes and leave him in the middle of the jungle, and with his hands tied also. So he is blindfolded, hands and feet tied with a blindfold. Along comes some passerby, sees this poor fellow sitting there, and realizes the person needs help, so unties the hands and feet, unties the blindfold. You can see the significance of the guru here. So unties the blindfold, but not just untie the blindfold. The fellow says, I come from Gandhara. Can you tell me the way to go to Gandhara? And the guru says, I'll show you. And the guru shows him the path that he needs to follow to reach his destination. So this is the metaphor given. Different Upanishads will describe the qualifications of a guru in different ways. This comes in the Chandogya Upanishad, untying the blindfold and showing the way. There are different ways of expressing it. There's a very famous story. The second example comes from the Bhagavad Gita. Tad vidhi iti smrte hetata. And also we understand it from the quotation, tad vidhi, in the Bhagavad Gita. Some of you know this verse. I don't remember. I don't have the verse memorized, so I'll share it with you here. This is chapter 4, verse 34. Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshyanti te jnanam jnaninaha tattva darshinaha. He says, tad vidhi, you should gain this knowledge. How? Pranipatena, by approaching a guru with humility. Pariprashnena, by approaching a guru with your questions. And sevaya, approaching a guru with your willingness to do whatever is necessary. Seva means supporting the guru so that the teachings can take place. And then Sri Krishna says, te jnaninaha, those enlightened ones, te jnaninaha, tattva darshinaha, those enlightened ones, te upadekshyanti, they will impart unto you jnanam. So a very beautiful, simple verse comes in chapter 4, the necessity of a guru. Can you do it on your own? And there's so many people who, I mean, we all learn things on our own. No doubt you have learned many skills on your own. But on your own means completely on your own? Or you had some resource helping you in one way or the other? Sometimes those resources are on YouTube or a friend. Or if I ask you, if you give me some really good food and I say, how did you learn to cook so well? Many of you, from my mother. Very typical kind of thing. So oftentimes there is a guru, maybe not in a formal sense, maybe in an informal sense. But here the point is, and I hinted at it when we began this discussion, when you turn your attention within to discover your true nature as Satchitananda Atma, will take some proper guidance. So it's not something you're likely to figure out on your own. Now, many people say, but Swamiji, what about this person and what about that person? They didn't have a formal guru, and yet they figured out things on their own. For example, Sri Ramakrishna as an example, or Sri Ramana Maharshi as another example. They didn't study with a guru in a very formal sense. Of course, those two examples commonly given, both Ramana and both of them and Sri Ramakrishna, they were spiritual geniuses. And what I would suggest is, if you also are a spiritual genius, you probably don't need, in fact, probably, you definitely don't need to attend my classes. If you are a spiritual genius, why would you come here? You're pointless. So the point being that few of us, myself included, are spiritual geniuses, so we require the help. Have a guru. Okay, enough said. A little bit more. One more verse about guru. Shankara says, Sagurus tarayet yuktam, Sagurus tarayet yuktam, Shishyam shishyagunan vitam, Shishyam shishyagunan vitam, Brahmav. Brahma vidya plave nashu, Brahma vidya plave nashu, Swanta dvanta maho dadhim, Swanta dvanta tamho dadhim. Sa guruhu, that guru who is qualified, tarayet, should help the disciple cross over, and he's going to give an example in the second half. So cross over the metaphoric ocean of samsara, we'll see that in a moment, but should help the student. What kind of student? So far we've talked about what kind of teacher. Now Shankara includes what kind of student, because there are plenty of students who aren't ready for these teachings. So what kind of student is ready for these teachings, properly prepared? We've already discussed the most crucial step of preparation is the recognition of the futility of worldly efforts to give you perfect peace and contentment. That recognition is one of the most important criteria for any student, but not the only criteria. So the student should be, Shankara says, yuktam, disciplined, committed. Not, how should I say it? Vedanta is not a hobby. So that's shishyam. That student in the second line should also be shishya guna anvitam, endowed with the qualities of a good guru, of a good shishya, a good disciple. By the way, sometimes we get a wrong idea about who is that right shishya. If the one who I don't know how to put this. The one who just says, yeah. Or let me try it the Indian way. Yeah. you get the point. The one who just agrees and accepts everything the teacher says is not necessarily the best student, because this isn't a matter of faith. It's not a matter of belief or agreement. Yes, I agree. I agree with everything the guru says. Who are you to agree or disagree, first of all? But I'm just pointing out that this just... Even the one who praises the guru, oh, this is the greatest guru, that doesn't make you a good student. In fact, you may be surprised by this observation. I would say the best student is one who is willing to challenge. Not challenge, that's the wrong word. One who comes to the guru with all the questions. In fact, that's what Sri Krishna said, pariprashnena. The one who has many questions for the guru, which means they don't just blindly swallow everything the guru says, they don't just blindly praise everything the guru says and does, but they question everything. That questioning, to me, shows a certain sincerity of intent. The intent is to discover your true nature. And it's not completely straightforward. It's natural that questions are going to arise. So the one, this seems counterintuitive, the one who asks the most questions, think about it like a college class. Somebody who asks lots of questions, you're probably thinking, they don't seem to understand anything. But here it's the opposite. The one who asks the most questions is perhaps, we don't know, but perhaps the one with the most sincere attitude of wanting to discover in a very personal way what the guru has discovered. So that idea of questioning is very important here. And then the culmination here is that the guru, Brahma Vidya Plavena Ashu Swanta Dvanta Mahodadim. We have to connect that to Tarayet up at the top. The guru Tarayet helps you cross over. Helps you cross over what? In the last line, Swanta Dvantam Mahodadim. Mahodadi ocean. But what kind of ocean? An ocean of dvanta, an ocean of darkness. Swanta, inner darkness. The ocean of inner darkness is very poetic. I like these poetic expressions. It's a poetic way of describing ignorance. And swanta dvanta mahodhadim, an ocean of ignorance. What that refers to is how deeply identified you are with your body and mind. That identification kicked in shortly after, I won't say shortly after you were born, I don't know, maybe by the time we're 1 or 2 years old, you know, we start identifying very intensely with our, very, very strongly with our bodies and minds. And that identification has been built up year after year after year. How many years have you been building it up? You don't have to tell us. But more than a few years. It's very deeply embedded. That deeply embedded identification with your body and mind here is called Swanta Dvantam Mahodadim, a vast ocean of ignorance, a deep, deeply established habitual identification with your body and mind. And how does a guru help you cross over that? Brahma Vidya Plavena. Ashu, immediately, that guru helps you with a, well, according to the metaphor, how do you cross an ocean? You need a plava, a boat. And in this case, the boat is Brahma Vidya Plava, a boat in the form of roadmap. So that boat is the boat in the form of the scriptures. And just, you know, this metaphor has been used so many times, but let me point out something you may not have thought about. Who rows the boat? Guru. The guru rows the boat in the right direction. What are you doing? You just sit there and go along for the ride. And the point I'm there's a subtle and somewhat technical point to be seen in that. The guru makes the effort. Does a shishya make no effort? That's not true. And the shishya makes significant efforts. So as Sri Krishna says, there is pariprashnena, by asking questions, pranipatena, with this dedication, sevaya, and with service. So definitely the student makes effort. But that's the effort, like, to relate it to the metaphor, that's the effort to find the guru and get in the boat. You know, one of the problems the metaphor shows is that if you want to cross a river or an ocean, you better find someone to help you. You're not going to swim, so you better find someone who knows how to cross and someone who has a boat. There's our Kshatriyam and Brahmanishtam once again. That requires effort. getting in the boat, metaphorically, finding the right boat, the right guru, and getting in the boat, all of that requires effort. Now here's the point I'm leading up to. Once you've made that effort, how much effort you've made in your own spiritual lives, you've made a lot of effort to come to this point, to attending this class, to having enough background where you can understand this class. It's not an introductory class. So a lot of effort has preceded this class. Suppose in this class, I express the teachings of Vedanta in such a way that it clicks. You really get it. Tell me, to that moment in which it clicks, does that require a lot of, are you really struggling? I have to understand this. Do you know those moments when it clicks are effortless? It just happens spontaneously. Self-recognition, self-realization requires no effort. When you stand in front of a mirror, how much effort does it take to recognize a person reflected? It's effortless. The guru gives is like the, another metaphor, guru is like the one holding the mirror in front of you. There's the guru, seriously, the guru makes the effort. And the effort is using the teachings of Vedanta. I mean, to use my own guru's words, using the teachings of Vedanta to create a situation in which you cannot but see. In a situation in which you cannot but discover your true nature. The guru makes that effort for you. The effort's already been made. At this point, it's there's some continued effort, but that moment of realization, you know, to continue coming to classes, all of that is an effort, I admit. But the point here is that moment of realization is effortless. So really, the guru does all the work. Okay, that's the end of that topic. And we have one more. We have time here. The next topic is Shankara's analysis of experience. He does this a lot, and it's such an important kind of Vedantic inquiry. What is the nature of experience itself? And he says, drishti, sprishti, shrutir, gratir. Drishti, smriti, shrutir, gratir. Matir, vignatir, evacha. Matir, vignatir, evacha. Shaktayo, nyascha, bhidyante. Shaktayo, nyascha, bhidyante. Chidrupatwe, pyat. Pyutparibihi, Chidrupatwe Pyutparibihi. Just see one thing. Okay. So here, he describes experience as in terms of what we all experience. Drishtihi, seeing. Sprishtihi, touching. Shrutihi, hearing. Gratihi, smelling. Matihi, thinking. Nyatibihi, knowing. Just as examples of what we experience today and every day. He says that all of these are shaktayaha. All of these are shaktis, capacities. Capacities of consciousness or capacities of your mind? This is tricky. In fact, it's a trick question. The power to have all these experiences, are these shaktis of your mind, or are they shaktis of consciousness? And it's a trick question. And the answer is yes. That's right. And the way to understand it is, if consciousness is present and the mind is not, can you have these powers? If the mind is absent, like in dreamless sleep or samadhi? Okay, so mind has to be present. But if mind is present and consciousness is absent, by the way, is a logical impossibility, and we'll see that in just a moment, but hypothetically, if mind is present and consciousness is absent, or if brain is present and consciousness is absent, then are these capacities possible, these powers? No. So that's why it's a trick question. Do these powers belong to mind or consciousness? The answer is yes. But, and there's a big but here, we have to understand the relationship between consciousness and mind, which we'll see in just a moment. So Shankara first says that all of these powers, anyahacha vidyante, they're all mutually different. These powers of being able to see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, think, etc., feel. Interesting, Shankara doesn't talk much about emotions. Little insight into Shankaracharya's nature. You know, would you leave out, if you were describing your life of experience, would you leave out emotions? Shankara does. Just a little insight into his nature and the nature of his disciples. So we always need to frame the context when we're studying any text. And that's one of the, this is where the guru has to work, is to recognize the context and then expand the context if necessary for the current context. Shankara's context is teaching a bunch of, his disciples were all sannyasis. So our context is very different. So anyway, Shankara was not highly focused on dealing with emotions. Perhaps we should be, since emotions are such a big part of our lives. So all of these things, anyaha cha bhidyante, they all differ from one another. How is that? Chidrupa tve api upadi bihi. They differ from each other, chidrupa tve, even though they are all manifestations of consciousness, they differ upadi bihi according to their upadi, and there's our technical term again. Upadi, how about the academic translation is not very helpful, but conditioning, adjunct. So what does it mean to say that all of these powers are, let me paraphrase, and then I need, this is, there's a very important point I want to make at the end of this class, that it will show the relationship between consciousness and all of these mental faculties. How are they related? We said that both are necessary. Mind plus consciousness are necessary. But how are these two related? They're related like clay and pot. Let's go back to the trick question. If you want, it's a little bit like the cups they make for tea, they used to make for tea in India. Not quite like this, but a little bit like that. So if you want some tea, do you need a pot or do you need clay? Trick question once again. If you have pot and no clay, show me one. Doesn't exist. If you have clay and no pot, it's not going to help you drink tea. So you see, it's this combination, and it's a combination of clay, substance, underlying reality, with nama rupa, name and form. Now that word upadhi is very clearly understood with this metaphor. Pot is an upadhi for clay. This is the correct usage of the word upadhi in Sanskrit. It, by the way, vernacular languages may also use that word in different ways. In Sanskrit, pot is an upadhi for clay, meaning pot makes clay appear in the form of pot. Notice clay has no form of itself. The upadhi is that which imparts form and function to clay. Clay in and of itself, in the metaphor, please know this is a metaphor. In the metaphor, clay is formless and clay cannot perform the function of holding tea for you. So it is the upadhi of pot that imparts form and function to clay, which has no form or function of itself. Now that's our metaphor. In the same way, your mind as pot is an upadhi for clay. Your mind is an upadhi for consciousness. Consciousness in and of itself has no form or function. It just is. It's an absolute fundamental reality. It doesn't have a particular function. As we said before, it doesn't do anything. So, your mind, however, imparts unto that consciousness, which has no form or function. Form and function are imparted by mind. Just as pot imparts form and function to clay, your mind imparts form and function to consciousness. We want to go into that? I don't think so. So, what that means then is all of these powers, these powers, seeing, hearing, thinking, etc., have two underlying factors. Just as this object has two factors involved. There are two factors involved here. There's an underlying material, clay, and there is a form and function due to the upadhi we call pod. This two-aspect analysis is crucial to understand the relationship between mind and consciousness. These are the two factors. The power of seeing, drishtihi, is due to consciousness with mind that imparts form and function of seeing. To be, what is next? Sprishtihi, the experience of feeling, is due to consciousness with your mind imparting the form and function of touching. Similarly, for all of these, thinking and knowing, consciousness with form and function superimposed by the mind. And there's one more final point to make here. When the upadhi pot imparted form and function to clay, from the standpoint of clay, did clay get changed in a fundamental way? Did this stop being clay when it was made into a pot? It continues to be clay. It will always be clay. Now that shows that the clay exists at a different level of reality. It's a more fundamental level of reality, an unchanging level of reality. And this is such an important point. We'll conclude the class with this observation. When your mind imparts form and function to your consciousness, consciousness remains utterly unaffected. Just as This clay remains clay, even in the form of the pot. Consciousness remains consciousness, even when the mind imparts sadness to consciousness. See where this goes? When the mind has this form of sadness, grief, frustration, anger, whatever it is, when that mind imparts its form to consciousness, how is your consciousness affected? This is Vedanta. Of course, you feel like you're affected by the sadness and frustration of your mind, just as you might, if you don't think about it, you might assume that this is clay got changed into a pot. Clay didn't get changed into a pot. Your consciousness didn't truly get affected by the sadness, frustration, etc. And the reason that's not intuitively obvious, you've already hinted at, this habitual identification with your body and mind. You've spent your whole life thinking that your consciousness is affected by every little thing that happens to you. This is our baseline thinking. This is your fundamental assumption. Of course, it all affects me. My consciousness is affected by anything and everything that happens. We have to undo that mistake. This clay did not change when it took the form of a pot. Your consciousness didn't change when it arose in a form of sadness. We have to undo a lot of wrong thinking in your mind. By the way, that's the work for the guru. So the guru has to, what is it? The expression, have to earn your keep. So I have to earn my keep by helping you undo this habitual wrong thinking about the relationship between consciousness and mind, and we'll come back to the next verses and we'll continue to work on that particular problem. We'll conclude here with a prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat. That one is all.